Chapter 2. My Childhood Days. I was born the fifth child in a family of eight on April 18, 1925, in St. Jacques, New Brunswick, a small village near the border of the province of Quebec, in eastern Canada. My parents were devout French Catholics. On my father's side of the family, two of his sisters were nuns, and his younger brother, a priest who later became a Monsignor of the Roman Catholic Church. Even now, I can't help admiring how my parents diligently followed the teachings and requirements of their church. As far back as I can remember, our home had daily family prayer. The evening prayer period I remember best. The rosary was the main part of the service, but we also repeated the litany of the saints. It consisted in calling out the names of about 100 or more saints and asking them to pray for us. As children, our knees became sore from kneeling so long a time, but we were encouraged to offer the suffering to God, that in turn he could use it to relieve some poor soul for a short while from the torment of the flames and agony of purgatory. Our family practiced many types of bodily humiliations in order to gain favor before God. Every Friday we abstained from meat. On the first Friday of every month, if a person went to confession and received communion, he was assured of indulgences that amounted to 5,000 days less in purgatory for a particular soul. In those days, it meant taking no food or water from the evening before until after one had received communion the following morning. The church has since changed this rule. It was customary at certain times of the year for the members of our family to hold an all-night vigil. Each of us took turns kneeling for 1 hour before a statue and saying the rosary or other prayers. The Lenten period preceding Easter was also a time of great self-mortification. My parents were God-loving people, and all activities of their lives revolved around Him. To please God was their main objective. When I was 3 years old, I became extremely sick, and the doctors gave up on my getting well. In fact, my father made arrangements for my funeral. Then my mother promised God that if I became well again, she would do everything in her power to see that when I grew up, I would be a priest, living to glorify his name and bring others to serve him. According to her, an immediate improvement took place, and my recovery was rapid and complete. The time came for me to prepare for my first communion. The more I memorized of the catechism, however, the teachings and commandments of the church, the more difficult I found it to harmonize its teachings with what I knew of the gospel of Christ. The priest read a chapter from either one of the four gospels or one of the epistles before his sermon on Sunday, and I always enjoyed it tremendously. Once when I was about 7 years old, we were returning home from church one beautiful winter day. The sun shone brightly, and about 20 horse-drawn sleighs were following one another. The sound of all those bells on the sleighs didn't allow much conversation. Everyone rode along in silence. Then I broke it by asking my mother why Jesus was so kind to people when he walked on earth and became so mean after he went to heaven. What makes you ask that? She said. Why would a good God burn people in purgatory for hundreds of years over little offenses? I inquired. He certainly does not practice what he taught. You and Dad practice what you teach us. Why doesn't he? You teach us to forgive one another's offenses. Shouldn't God also forgive completely? As I looked into her face, I could see that such reasoning puzzled her. My father tried to help her by appealing to higher authorities. You see, son, it's like your Uncle Felix, the priest, once said, God hates sin so much that to help people turn away from it, he had to attach a great penalty to it. And besides, our Holy Father, the Pope, knows of other good reasons why God uses purgatory. And we must not question the Pope's authority. Taught the transubstantiation doctrine, I accepted it as any other child of my age did, believing that in the Eucharist, the priest changed the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ. But on Easter Sunday, 1937, the year my mother died, I heard something that led me to think differently. The priest read from one of the Gospels about the resurrection of Christ. What fascinated me was the fact that Jesus had a hard time convincing his disciples that he was, in reality, resurrected, that he was a being with real flesh and bones and not a spirit. A couple of interesting questions popped into my mind. Could it be that heaven is a real place, like on earth, where people with flesh and bones can live real lives and not be spirits floating on clouds? But if Jesus is not a spirit, how can he be in the host? It is probably difficult for some people to understand how a small child could lose faith in God and turn against religion in the way that I did. Perhaps I can explain what happened by recounting several incidents. As a youngster, what I heard and saw in the lives of adults impressed me deeply. Our home was a place where peace and joy abode. My parents gave us a good example of how people should get along together. They practiced kindness and consideration for others, and in turn expected us to forgive one another's shortcomings and be kind. Our parents were forever helping the poor and needy. In my estimation, I felt that God should at least be as kind and compassionate towards humans as he expected them to be towards each other. One particular experience greatly perplexed my mind. In those days, people did not use their cars during the winter months, and it sometimes took quite an amount of work to put a car back into running order for use during warmer weather. My dad decided to have a mechanic who lived in Edmundston spend a couple of days getting his Model A Ford in condition. Before my father went to see the man, he said, "The man is Protestant, but a very fine person and an excellent mechanic. Now, children, listen to me. It may well be that as we recite the Angelus at noon, before having our meal, that he will not participate in our devotions. Please do not stare at him, and above all, don't ask embarrassing questions pertaining to his religion. You understand?" and as he spoke, he looked directly at me. In unison, we all replied, "Yes, Dad." For 3 days, the man worked on the car, and I enjoyed watching him. He was all Dad had told us and more. A kind man, he seemed to enjoy talking to me, nor did he use profanity. My father owned and operated 3 farms, and of course employed quite a few men. Many times I heard him say, when he had decided to hire a new man, "Friend, I know that you and I will get along well together. I'm not hard to please. But one thing I want you never to forget. My wife and I don't allow people who work for us to blaspheme God or the saints. We have children whom we are trying to bring up to reverence God. So watch your words." Despite his request, they forgot themselves while working and called down all the saints from heaven with profanities. But if the Protestant mechanic happened to skin his knuckles or pinch his finger, all he said was, "Ouch, that hurts." As for the Angelus, I found the mechanic to be more reverent than we were. When Dad said, "Let us pray," he bowed his head, closed his eyes, and folded his hands. We never closed our eyes and rushed through the Angelus as fast as possible. After the man left, something troubled me greatly, and I could not put it out of my mind. It was a phrase I had memorized from the Catechism. Translated, it stated, "Outside of the Roman Catholic Church, there is no salvation." My mother sensed that something was bothering me and asked about it. "Mother, where do the good Protestants go when they die?" "That's a good question, son. Why do you ask?" I quoted her what I had memorized from the Catechism. She admitted she did not know and suggested that we should ask my uncle when he came to visit us. My question must have also troubled her, for at the evening meal that day she told my father what we had talked about and asked his opinion on the subject. He did not have much of an answer, but commented that he felt that God wouldn't leave a good person out of heaven, regardless of whether he was a Catholic or a Protestant. Probably, he suggested, when a good Protestant dies, the angels lead him through the back door. Protestants do not have the glory of being welcomed by St. Peter personally, but they shouldn't care as long as they get in. They shouldn't expect to be treated as celebrities. After all, their forefathers made a bad mistake when they left the Catholic Church, and all their descendants can expect to suffer on account of it. Well, I concluded his reasoning was most likely correct. Those solemn words kept running through my mind. Outside of the Roman Catholic Church, there is no salvation. A few months went by, and finally we heard that my uncle, the priest, would be visiting all the relatives. I asked my father if he could, when the opportunity presented itself, ask Uncle Felix about the good Protestants. After we had visited for quite a while, my dad turned to my uncle and said, "Felix, tell me, where do the good Protestants go when they die?" "Why do you ask?" Dad explained my question in light of what the Catechism said. "What Roger has quoted to you from the Catechism is correct," Uncle Felix replied. "There is no salvation outside the Catholic Church, regardless of whom the person may be." His statement opened up quite a debate on the matter. My father claimed that it wouldn't be fair of God not to let a good Protestant into heaven. Well, my uncle took the heat out of the conversation by suggesting that the soul of a good Protestant probably went to limbo at death. It is supposed to be the place where the souls of unbaptized infants go when they die. One thing I do know, Uncle Felix concluded, according to the church, no Protestant, good or bad, will go to heaven or will ever see God. And remember, I didn't make the rules. I only teach them. If there was any possible way for a Protestant to get to heaven, our Holy Father the Pope surely would have told us. The experience placed a big question mark in my mind about God's justice. Time went by, and a couple of years later the matter of God's justice came up again. One beautiful July evening, someone passing by stopped to tell my parents that a neighbor had died suddenly while working about 5 miles from home. One statement disturbed everyone present. He died without having a priest to give him the last sacrament of the church. After mentioning that the dead man's brother was bringing the body home, the man left shaking his head from side to side while saying, "It's sad, sad, sad." I can remember that incident as if it were yesterday. Before too long, we saw a dilapidated horse-drawn wagon moving slowly down the road. A blanket covered the body, and the driver sat on the front of the wagon, legs dangling down, his face reflecting his despair. A couple of neighbors who had come to use our phone, our family had one of the only two telephones for miles around, were sitting on the front porch with us. After the body had passed our house, my mother commented on how sad it was. If only he could have had a priest to forgive his mortal sins so that he would not find himself going into hellfire. Let's hope he had only venial sins on his soul. That alone represents years of burning in the flames of purgatory. We'll have to get a few dollars together and have masses celebrated for the peace of his soul, my father said, for I can't see how his widow and the kids will be able to do so. One of the neighbors spoke up. I feel like telling you to save your money. I'm inclined to think that his soul is now in hell fire. You see, Mr. and Mrs. Murnau, this man was known to have had sticky fingers. What I mean to say is that he had at times taken things that were not his. That's a rather strong accusation, my father replied, and unless you're able to prove it, I would appreciate your not saying anything at all. I hate to say this, but do you remember that last year about this time you were unable to locate a log-dragging chain that you had bought only a short while before? If you were to go into his barn and look in one particular place, you would see your chain. I saw it there only a few days ago. As a matter of fact, I commented to the man about it, and he said that he had borrowed it from you, but that you didn't know about it. My father appeared shocked for a moment or two, but after regaining his composure, he said, "This is quite a revelation to me. Listen, everyone, I want you all to know that in the sight of God, I am giving to the dead man the chain that he had borrowed from me, even if he never had any intention of returning it. As a matter of fact, if he took anything else from me that I am not aware of, I give it to him also. In this way, his soul is freed from any condemnation he may have brought upon himself in the sight of God." "I don't mean to be irreverent toward God," his neighbor responded, "but right now I feel that you are kinder than he is. I must admit that this is the nicest gesture towards anyone I have ever seen or heard of. In fact, you may be the first human being ever to force God to take a soul out of hell fire and place him in purgatory until he is purified enough to enter heaven. That experience made quite an impact upon me. For many days that incident kept passing through my mind. As I meditated upon it, I agreed with the neighbor that my dad had a more noble character than the God he served. I concluded that God was most unkind in forcing souls to suffer in purgatory because the relatives had no money to have masses celebrated. One experience that served to turn me completely against God was that of the passing away of my own mother. During the spring of 1937, my mother went to the hospital for an operation. After a couple of weeks, they sent her home to live out her last days. Only 12 years old, I was at an impressionable age. Arriving home from school one day, I went into her bedroom to kiss her on the forehead, which I did daily. "Please sit down," she said. "I would like to say something that I feel is important to both of us. As you know, I have but a short time to be with you, and I want you to remember this bit of advice. As you make your way through life, show appreciation to people for their kindness toward you. Give thanks to them, even if it is only for a glass of water. People who express appreciation for small favors receive benefits in greater ways." In those days, it was customary to view the dead in their home, instead of at a funeral parlor. For 3 days, friends, relatives, and neighbors came to pay their respects and pray for my mother's soul. On the day of the funeral, many felt that our mother was in heaven next to God, because she had had so many rosaries recited for her. But that which made us feel best was the fact that my father had scheduled Gregorian masses for the peace of her soul. As our Uncle Felix explained to us, Gregorian masses have to be the most wonderful thing that can happen to someone's departed soul. He explained how Pope Gregory, who had a special concern for souls in purgatory, had devised them. The family arranges to have 300 masses celebrated at the same time in various parishes, convents, monasteries, etc., on a particular day. According to him, they have a redeeming power sufficient to take a soul directly to heaven so that it would not even see the flames of purgatory. That same day, I heard a relative state that Gregorian masses cost $1 each, or in other words, $300 for the entire arrangement. The thought entered my mind that we were most fortunate that our father could afford to help our mother get to heaven so nicely. Then I remembered a woman who had died 6 months earlier in our parish, because the family was too poor to have any masses celebrated. She would have to suffer in purgatory. Her funeral arrangements had upset my father greatly, since he was a member of the welfare committee of our parish. Later in the day, he sat down for his evening meal, then decided he would pass it up. My mother, sensing his mood, asked whether something was wrong. "Yes, I might as well tell you," he said. I have spent the better part of the afternoon at the church presbytery with the other members of the welfare committee, discussing the problems of the poor in our parish. The main item of concern was the purchasing of a coffin for poor old Annie. I wasn't against trying to save a little money, but when Father Paquin asked the funeral director how much we would save if we had the crucifix and handles of the coffin removed before burial, I became upset and felt like giving the good father a piece of my mind. But I held back because of respect for his office. To put an end to the discussion, I said I would pay the difference in the cost. Things of this kind somehow get to me. It's a sad, sad thing to be poor in this day and age, especially when it comes to dying. As I thought upon both incidents, I couldn't help feeling that God was most unjust by allowing the misery going on in our world to continue. As time went on, I lost confidence in God and the church and determined to have nothing to do with either as soon as I would be old enough to be on my own. In the fall of 1937, my father sent my brother Edgar and me to a boarding academy operated by the nuns of L'Hôtel Dieu de Saint Basile. I received a good deal more religious instruction that served only to further harden my heart. From outward appearances, no one would have dreamed of the conflict going on in my soul. Step by step, I turned away from God in disgust and hate. A few years went by, then World War II came along, and with it a call to serve my country.